welcome to Twig 278, where we read and distill all the weekly game industry news so you don't have to. Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Jen Donahoe, strategic marketing consultant at Beta Hat and Jade Inferno. And today we have Philip Black, game economist at Game Economist Consulting.
Hey, hey.
Eric Kress, principal at Gossamer Consulting Group and sick as a dog.
I am, my whole family is sick traveling all over this great wide world, but I'm powering through.
The travel plague has hit you. And then Mishka Katkov, Pope of Deconstructor of Fun.
Church. Thank you so much for the introduction. And hey.
Amen.
Amen.
All right. Hallelujah. All right. Here's what we're going to cover today. Kress is going to recount why he's sick because he was in London. Is the AAA game studio dead? There were a few articles that we want to debate. Should there be tipping in games? And our new fake segment is show reviews because transmedia is real. This week, let's do Fallout. Phil, why don't you kick us off?
I'm a couple episodes into the Fallout TV show. This is one of the most authentic and best video game adaptions I've seen. They got the world right. And if you don't know, this is by Jonathan Nolan, who is the brother of Christopher Nolan, of course, the director of The Dark Knight Rises, in addition to a litany of other successes. He also redeemed himself from Westworld. He was the creator of Westworld, too. And if you know anything about Westworld,
that
went off a hill. You know, I think this is just an embarrassment to Halo and that piece of shit TV show.
I'm just sad
to see Halo just trash the source material compared to this. And now Halo has fallen even lower in my books. But has anyone seen this?
Dude, I fucking binge watched this shit till my eyes bleed. I was like watching this on the plane to and from London. It was crazy. Absolutely crazy. But by the way, Halo wasn't all that bad, dude. I think it lived up to my expectations of Halo. I mean, what do you expect from a Halo? I guess, whatever. Anyway.
Season 2 was a little bit better. I don't know really what happened at the end, but it was better.
That's how low bases work and low expectations. You can always exceed them.
I actually thought the Fallout thing was really, really good. A good story with really great acting, just in general. Like, everyone was kind of believable. Some really memorable characters. I'm not really into anything to do with Fallout lore, or I have no idea what that's all about. There was a lot of noise from people out there that were not too happy or disappointed about how true to the lore they were, but I say get over it. I thought the story was good, and I think they did a great job, and it was really entertaining, and I can't wait till the next season, so I'm hooked.
I've not seen it, but really want to. I was kind of on Shogun, so now I got to kick over to Falk. If you haven't seen Shogun, please
the best.
Watch Shogun. It's so amazing. Anyway, according to Matt Piscatella from, you know, Circana and NPD, their player engagement tracker, Fallout 76, is currently seeing its highest engagement rate on Xbox Series consoles. Daily percentage of active XBS player playing since October 2022. Transmedia is a thing, Mishka. Come on. All right, Phil, what else you got?
No, Mishka, would you like to take a shit on this, or should I go first?
I'm not going to take a shit on it, but it's the same thing that happened with the Cyberpunk. I think it was Cyberpunk. Anyways, so what I'm trying to get at is that the base levels are so low with Fallout, to my knowledge, because there haven't been a new game in a while, then whenever there's an interest rising again and people are playing these games once again, then the jump is significant. But it's just a short spike, and it goes back down. I think we've seen this with Last of Us. I think we've seen it with a few other games. And when it comes to transmedia, like if this was a thing, which it might be, I might be totally wrong, most likely I am, then they're launching games that have nothing to do with their catalog. And just like Hades came out right now. I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't cover Netflix games. I was just thinking about transmedia and this part.
There's a total lack of marginal analysis when it's come to this, and it's really bothered me. So remember, there was an 80% discount on all of these games. So there's normal price elasticity effects here. So we first of all have to take away some attribution due to price elasticity effects. And even if you look at the unit increase in sales, even if we give 100% attribution across the portfolio, so not just the HD titles, but also Fallout Shelter is up as well, you know, based on some back of the envelope math I did, you know, maybe we're talking about a 5 million bump, and that's being extremely generous. And remember, there's other effects here. It's not just the sale, but it was featured on the store Steam page. There's a bunch of other effects that are happening here. But even if we gave 100% attribution to this and we did some back of the envelope math on revenue, maybe $5 million in incremental revenue. And if that is the case, you need to factor in how expensive this TV show was to make and how expensive the marketing budget is. So it looked like it was about $150 million to make Fallout Season 1. Maybe we double that for marketing. So we're looking at a $300 million budget. Okay, 5% on top of that. I mean, what, 3%? Less than 3%? I mean, it's peanuts in the P&L. So like, if this is the best Transmedia has to offer, it's been a complete and utter disaster. And the other thing that I find interesting here is this never goes the other way. So whenever we see these TV shows come out, there's always this celebration of game numbers going up. But when, for instance, Spider-Man came out, no one was talking about like the Netflix Spider-Man streaming numbers or DVD sales. So it seems to only go in one direction. And it's because we still have this fucking inferiority complex in this industry that Hollywood is like the seal of approval. When Holly does well, it's a validation of who we are, and we need to get away from this bullshit, and we need to be strong, independent game makers who don't need no Los Angeles. That's all I have to say on the matter.
Oh my God, I didn't expect this to... All right, we're going to have a whole nother show on this because... Don't agree.
I couldn't have said it any better.
Yeah, Phil.
I 100% agree. Wow, the incremental revenue generated from this bullshit is so mice nuts that it doesn't fucking matter at all. When you're selling something for $5 or $6, who gives a fuck how much like percentage increase it is month over month because of the movie or television show? Just stop.
Brand awareness, though. Brand awareness. You can't measure it.
There's different people paying for things too. And then you have not just the games, you have other lines of business and other consumer products. Prime paid for the show, Prime paid for the marketing, not the developer. And so the developer is just getting, you know, a halo effect, pun intended, as a result of the IP being bigger. It extends the length of the IP. Okay, anyway, we all disagree, and that's fine.
I actually agree with what Jen said as well. So there's like a long-term game there as well.
Long-term,
so
it's
like it builds the franchise. It builds a franchise, but like,
yes.
But it's not a financial windfall.
Yes.
It's basically a quote unquote halo effect for the entire franchise to make it bigger. And people maybe likely will, again, tune into the next Fallout. Of course, next Fallout game is like a fucking decade away because they're working on Elder Scrolls right now. So like exactly how is this halo going to help Fallout, right? Even in the medium term, you know?
That part is a fuck up, right? Like, so you should... This is what franchise planning is, and you should have effectively schedule out the content that builds the world, and then the content supporting the world should be closely aligned in timing. This is one of my jobs when I was at Disney, is to say, okay, for Power Rangers or Toy Story or some of these, like, what do you do in the world for content? And then how do you extend that into consumer products or other experiences so that, you know, you've got the big burst and then you've got the tail that leverages all of those different things. And I agree, it seems like the timing of this probably didn't align well to really make use of that. All right, let's move on. We're going to shill now because we're still at the beginning of the show.
Most important part of the show, the shill.
Oh yeah, here we go. There was a great write-up by Ken Landon in the Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. By the way, we have a newsletter, everybody, and we still have a blog. So please go check out Legends of Mushrooms. This Friday, Ken, Laura, and I are going to record a product deep dive. So it'll probably be on YouTube late next week. And Chris, I'm dying to hear about your London adventures, but I think Mishka wants to shill some more first.
Yeah. Like, we can't leave it with one shill. So before Chris starts talking about his fanboys and fangirls in London, I wanted to mention two podcasts that dropped this week. So earlier in this week, we had an app monetization trends podcast with Qualys' John Wright and Google's Ross Brockman. This was sort of a continuation of the discussions we had in Felix back in the earlier part of this year, or was it the end of 2023? Either or, but a lot about ad monetization, and things are not, you know, as great as they were before, maybe. So listen to that. And then we had Chris-related podcasts with Gürkem Türk of Laton Ventures. So this is something we recorded at GDC. It's a Turkish delight, if you will. A very Istanbulish conversation. This is a new fund out of Istanbul, exporting the know-how of the Turkish gaming scene abroad. So both investing in Turkey as well as in the the companies outside Turkey. So very interesting conversation with Gürkem.
Dude, Gürkem's the boss, dude. He raised $35 million.
It's more than that already.
Who's done that, dude?
It's more than that.
Play Ventures. Like, none of those guys have done that shit, right?
Yeah, I think I can say the Supercell is their LP as well. So they got some really good companies investing. So it's a rare opportunity to invest into a fund operating out of Turkey.
Gürkem's an animal. All right. London Venture Partners. So I was invited to the London Venture event. Evidently, they do it yearly. I think last year it was in Lisbon. This year it was in London. What was really cool, it coincided with the BAFTAs, which is the awards ceremony for gaming in London. And it was actually hosted at the BAFTA building in London near Piccadilly. For those that are unfamiliar, LVP kind of was one of the OG gaming venture capital firms founded by David Gardner of EA fame, David Key and Paul Hayden. Some of the notable investments are Supercell, Unity, Playfish, which was acquired by EA, and Natural Motion, which was acquired by Zynga. Actually, I don't want to speak out of turn, but those deals were really interesting back in the day. Kind of the OG EA mafia selling companies to each other. That's really interesting. But basically, it's a yearly conference that they do. I think a lot of these VC firms do that, where they have the LPs there. What I didn't know about them was that the majority of their LPs are actually strategics or companies that are in the industry. So it is more of a who's who of the industry that's invested in their firm. And that's a little bit different than BitCraft. Again, the guest list was really impressive. Garena, Google, Hasbro, Tencent, Wargaming, etc. And guess who was there? Frank Jabal was there. The CD Projekt guys were there, the founders. Lars from Embracer was there. And generally, I do not go to these type of conferences for one simple reason. One is that senior executives are PR trained and they don't tell you jack shit, right? So it doesn't help me or my business, generally speaking. But to be clear, I'm rarely invited to these type of events. So there's that. But nonetheless, there were some really interesting folks there. Unfortunately, I did miss Lara's presentation because I was hanging out with the wife the second day. Anyway, Anuzu gave another presentation on the current state of gaming, which I really thought was good. Kind of a good wake-up call for the execs in the room. My panel, of course, was the best.
Of course.
There's actual game makers talking about AI. Of course, right? And so I think it went over reasonably well. But I'll be honest, I came away from the conference, which was kind of an AI-geared conference. I came a little less bullish on AI than I was going into it, only because, like, you know, the jargon and acronyms was like the primary way of communicating about this opportunity versus like the consumer value prop, you know, and I get worried, you know, feels like a lot like more like blockchain, but not nearly as bad, I suppose, but I still feel there were kind of less practical use cases and more technology people talking technology, which is not as interesting. But nonetheless, it was a great event. Hopefully we'll get invited again. I don't think I insulted too many people, but I was pretty frank up there, so to speak.
Speaking of Frank, did he like see you and run the other direction?
I'll be honest, I wasn't feeling a lot of love, but you know, he's a busy man. He don't give a fuck,
no,
dude.
No, it's at the end of the day,
the guy's counting his millions. You know, like, what does he care? I do really want to listen to the presentation for Lars. I think the one thing that I did get feedback on from other people was that he was very humble. You know, it's like he got up there and he said the most obvious thing in the world. He's like, it's far easier to buy companies than sell companies.
Okay. Point.
Honestly, I'm really glad that I wasn't there for it because I would have been so hard pressed not to say and ask a very inappropriate question. And that question would be, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? You know, like, I mean, how is this ever possibly going to be successful? But of course, luckily, I did not get the chance to put my big foot in my mouth. But I can say it here, but not in there. So there you go.
You said something interesting about AI, and I struggle with it as well, is because so much of it is very tech heavy, they need like a product marketer who understands the tech to then turn it into usable either consumer language or internal game development language that helps people really understand what they're trying to do. Because I am struggling in the same way. People from the outside ask me, oh, how is AI helping with games? And I'm like, I don't know.
I 100% agree. Nothing is worse than blockchain. Like, oh, that is you the go worst. Like one layer deep, and dude, you are in the fucking tech muck. You know, like it is bad. And I, you know, maybe I'm a half a moron, I'll admit, but like it's just bad. I think AI is a little bit easier to understand because there's certain you're actually executing certain things with AI in order to help facilitate development, but it's still they spent more time on the technology side and not they just got to get rid of the word AI in general. And I think you've said this before on how to describe it. Just say they're building a better game.
Yeah, just talk about the benefit, not about using all of the jargon.
100%. 100%. There's so many pitches that I've gone through, which is like, there's no value statement. It's just like, we're doing this. And you're like, why? And they're like, because we can. It's just, okay, interesting.
All right. Well, next year, let's all go because this sounded like a lot of fun. And we could go in we could be the peanut gallery and heckle everyone. All right. Corrections.
Maybe not a correction, but Mishka, hold on. I thought you were going to talk about Supercell's web stores from last week.
So last week in the episode, we talked about web stores and we threw a lot of numbers of like how much the web stores are making. And of course, we've heard of multiple different companies saying that some of their top titles make up to 50% in revenue from web stores. Now, when we discussed and I was like, hey, we could look at Supercell's revenues because those are public, compare them to the Sensor Tower or Data AI revenues and maybe see some kind of a delta. That's a bad indication, but those are the only numbers that we're working with. So I went I did this quick research. So according to Sensor Tower, Supercell's revenues were $1.8 billion, and this is roughly the same that they actually reported. So it was a surprisingly accurate number on Sensor Tower, and well, of course, it's accurate with the official statements. So we don't really know what the part of web store revenues are, but according to this, it might not be that significant. We also know that Supercell doesn't really have ad revenue. I think there's some integration with Heyday still, but none of the other games have any ad revenue. So based on this very superficial research, the web store revenues are not that significant. But again, we're comparing Sensor Tower data to Supercell's official revenue numbers. And so might be a bad research, but I don't have any other data to pull from.
Look, actually, there's two things I want to talk about. It was painful listening to the podcast last week. I hate not being here to like counteract your nonsense. But like at the end of the day, this is what web stores are doing right now, right? Let's say you have a $100 million product 2 years ago in 2021. You were down like 40 to 50, let's say 50%. And at that time, you did like 20 million of web store revenue. And that's grown to 25 million in web store revenue. Well, guess what? Now, web store revenue is 50% of your business, right? But that's not a good thing, right? Because your business is still down 50 fucking percent, right? So I get it. The margin from the web store is great, but that ain't helping the bottom line of your business, right? Across these products, because fucking the IDFA has fucked up everybody with these existing products. So fine. Web store helps grow margin, but it ain't growing your business, you know? So stop it.
It also depends on the genres of the game. So talking to some of the developers, like with the more hardcore titles or monetizing titles, like let's say casino, strategy, RPGs, the web store revenues seem to be pretty significant. Again, what you said, Chris, might be 100% true. So that doesn't change things. But the titles that are not as hardcore or more on the casual side, we're hearing very small amount of revenue, mice nuts, if you will, coming in from web stores after all the integrations and the best practices being implemented. So genre specific based on hearsay.
And completely agree with that. And I think it harms Eric's move to the middle thesis, right? That this is what was supposed to happen post IDFA, because a lot of the web store concentration is in mid-core genres. And a lot of it is because it's driven by competitiveness, particularly in a 4X game. Like it's a competitive advantage to get more ROI per dollar spent because it makes it more likely that your clan is going to win. So that to me is totally consistent with what we'd expect. But that also reverses a lot of the trends that we see when we do genre level analysis. Mid-core is down. Okay, we start to make some assumptions about web store numbers, and maybe 4X isn't as bad as we think it is. Maybe Squad RPG isn't as bad as we think it is. And I think that harms this move to the middle thesis that you've been trouting.
The titles where web store revenues work especially well have a web skew. So it's kind of like, yes, they're playing it on web. They have a PC skew and they're making payments on that platform that they're playing. Yep. So there's even that element that we have to take into account.
that's just not what I'm hearing on the ground, mm-hmm. right? Like, you can say that and pontificate about it, but like at the end of the day, when you're talking to people that are, have products that are down 50%, like, you think that Garena, you know, is having a good time with their game down like 50%?
That started long ago. I would use Star Trek Fleet Command as another example of a game that looks like a downtrend line. When you look at third party intelligence, but when you look at some web store assumptions, I think that trend looks a lot different.
And that game has a PC skew.
The other piece of correction feedback I have, hopefully it doesn't get me in trouble with our friend Lexi at App.
Sensor Tower.
The fuck it is now. I have no idea what the hell to call it anymore.
It's Sensor Tower.
You can't change names on me, dude. I'm too old to change
tower.
My ways, you know?
It's now Sensor Tower.
You know what it is? It's
You still call him App Annie.
App Annie. And it's App Annie forever. Like, forever it's App Annie. God damn it. All right. Anyway, I thought that their projected revenue for gaming was a little bit ridiculous. And partially because I actually kind of agree that it's going up. I'm not really suggesting that I don't really agree with like the thing, but they fucking straight lined all the genres. Like, everything is equal, right? And I think it's a little bit lazy, right? Honestly. And there's this one chart that really bothered me because it was clearly like not a lot of thought was put in there. Because if you look at the revenue trends by genre, you know, they're completely different. They're all over the place. And then when they go into forecast, it's like straightened up and to the right for every single one equally. And I'm like, hey, come on. Like, you could actually make some assumptions around that. Clearly things are changing for different genres.
You've heard of Heroic Labs by now, and we keep talking about them because in today's mature market, you need every edge to be successful. Rather than spending those precious company dollars on building game tech, focus on building your game and shipping it. Get into your players' hands faster and grow your community. Heroic Labs is battle-tested partner and friend of the podcast. Their tech enables you to be flexible, creative, and scale for success. Heroic Labs has your tech stack covered. Whether you're looking for a world-class back-end game server, an amazing game development framework, fantastic live ops tooling, or reliable mass scalability, Heroic Labs has solutions for all of these challenges. And it's not just us at Deconstructor of Fun praising Heroic Labs. The company works with some of the world's biggest publishers on many of the beloved games. Focus on your game, save a big chunk of cheese, and avoid tech risks with Heroic Labs. This podcast is brought to you by Data AI. Now, you're asking, didn't they get acquired by Sensor Tower? They did, and that's awesome. Here's why. Whether you loved using data.ai or Sensor Tower, the combined company will offer customers even stronger and more detailed insights on the full digital customer journey. Exciting times lie ahead as Sensor Tower and Data AI join forces. Go to data.ai or sensortower.com and get on board with undeniably the best data partner in the business. Now, back to the episode.
So, quick hits. Here we go. Monopoly movie is in the works with Margot Robbie and Lionsgate. So, she's on fire. If you don't know Margot Robbie, she was Barbie, and she was a producer on the Barbie movie. And it seems like she has the sensibility to take toy brands and turn them into something. So, ironically, this is with rival Hasbro. Barbie is with Mattel. Dear Margot, if you need a consultant, please call me. Wouldn't it be great to work with her? On the advertiser side, some news coming out of MAU. So MAU is a mobile marketing conference that happened like the week after, the first week of April. And I didn't go this year because, number one, I was sick as a dog coming out of GDC, and it was like right after GDC. So they're moving it a little bit later next year so more people can go. But the ad network Moloco is adding an SDK. So in the high level speak for people, go tell your UA team to check out Moloco and their new SDK feature, because it's a way for them to really compete with the AppLovins, the Facebooks, and the Googles. It just seems like a new channel that is going to be really viable. So in the UK charts, we often talk about the US charts, Command & Conquer, we talked about them last week, a brand that I got a chance to work on. I had no idea this would happen, but they flooded the European charts in March after EA put out a bundle on Steam. 5 titles in with this series made it into the top 10, led by CNC Generals number 4. At number 4, The result means that new releases such as WWE 2K24, Rise of Ronin, Princess Peach Showtime charted lower than expected. There are 11 CNC titles in the top 20. Phil, this seems like a strategy that you'd love, like flood the market with paid downloads and leverage the brand awareness for back catalog. Actually, I think I kind of love this idea. What do you think?
I'm going to come around to it, to be quite frank. I mean, we didn't get to talk about Content Warning and their distribution strategy last week, and I hope to have a piece out this week. But they're doing like free-to-claim stuff, which I find very interesting. There might be something to this. Like, get your K-factor up a little bit, make some more money, you know, sacrifice a little bit of sales. It's a straightforward economic calculation. I hope we can talk more about these type of strategies in the future.
Basically, when they launched, and by the way, they launched on April Fool's Day, they launched for free, and they amassed a shit ton of downloads, and now they're selling it for $8 because I think it was like, it's like a 5-person team. If I remember correctly, I don't know. I looked this up a while ago, but I thought that strategy was just absolutely brilliant. Amass a bunch of people for free, transition to $8. You know, you've probably heard about it from your friends. So I think playing with some of these launch strategies is really fun. Phil, we should maybe pick it as a topic in a future episode. All right, moving on. Miska, investments.
Investments. Very slow week. Very, very slow week. Only two investments that I saw, really. One, of course, Web3. We can't get a 1 week without Web3 investment. So US-based AI and Web3 platform. Think about it. AI, Web3, and platform, all in one sentence. This is, of course, is getting funded. $4 million in seed funding. Naturally. Great sentence. Red Rover secures $15 million funding in Series A. A round goes towards development of their survival debut title. So this is the other investment. Red Rover was founded in June 2023, so less than a year ago, by Funcom, Bohemia Interactive, and Lockwood alumni, who told this was on VentureBeat, that they plan to drive a breakout growth for survival games. The team secured $5 million in funding at launch, and then the Series A came pretty quickly afterwards, so I bet that they have great results on playtests or something. But Crafton was leading this investment. Now, let's talk about some real raises, some big money raises. A16Z, one of the biggest, most prominent venture capital funds in the world, has raised a monster loot. So $7.2 billion for the following venture strategies. So they raise one pot that then they divide into different funds. One is American Dynamism. I don't know what that is, but it got $600 million. The number two is Apps. Apps got $1 billion. Games, so Games Fund 2, got $600 million. So Apps got almost twice the money that Games does. Interesting. Infrastructure, $1.25 billion, and Growth, $3.75 billion. So Growth is probably that they continue investing in the companies that are scaling that they have. So going back to Games Fund, so this is A16Z's Games Fund partner, Andrew Chen. He wrote on Twitter, I'm not going to say X, that this is an all new next generation fund that is dedicated to the intersection of tech and games. It is equally sized to our debut fund that we raised in 2022. And we are excited to invest this new fund across many stages and sectors from inception, accelerating, to Series A and B. And from AI infrastructure to Web3 games to VR, AR3 tooling, gamified apps, game studios, and much more. The fund targets a $300 billion industry that has spawned incredible companies over the past decade, and it's great to be able to build. Eric Kress, this creates a lot of emotion inside of you. I can see this.
Oh my God. This is everything Kress loves.
This is
everything.
Why is Kress not on Twitter?
To be clear, before I say this, this is not bad for gaming. This is actually good for gaming, right? It is good to have funds out there investing in gaming, new projects, new innovations.
Incubating speedrun. That's
incubating new platforms. Yeah, you know, like just throw spray and pray, dude. Spray and motherfucking pray, right? But I can't imagine this is good for LPs. You know, raising another $600 million for games. They already had $600 million. Mm-hmm. So $1.2 billion. What the fuck are they going to be investing in to get the type of returns required for venture capital, right? I don't know. I keep coming to the same conclusion as I think the All In podcast guys are, is that VCs are now like RIAs, right? They're basically registered investment advisors. They become capital raising machines, you know, and they are getting compensated based upon the capability of raising money as opposed to actual, like, real returns, you know? And so these management fees are like, you know, 1-2%, you know, and at 600 million, dude, that's 12 million bucks for the team. That's a lot of cheddar, right? I honestly think it's literally impossible to generate better returns than market returns in the next 10 years in gaming with $600 million. For smaller funds, absolutely possible. Absolutely, because the required returns are much lower from a dollar figure perspective. I hope I'm wrong. But I think I'd rather put my money in the VTI. And so I don't really understand what LPs are seeing that I'm not seeing in this particular circumstance. But I don't think this is good for LPs necessarily. And I think this could potentially cut off investment in gaming over the longer term, causing issues later. But let's just hope that they can figure out what's going to make these type of returns. Anybody else?
I have a question.
Besides me?
So all the speed runs that are going on, you know, if you're a little company and you go out and you, let's say you raise $750,000 in a speed run and A16Z is now on your cap table, is that good or bad for all these little, explain this to me, please.
So it depends, as always. So if you have the right traction and A16Z believes in you, it couldn't be better because they have infinite money. So they will fund you until you IPO. But the challenge becomes in a situation, because they fund so many through speedrun, is if, let's say, I'm an investor and this type of a company would come to me and say, hey, I'm raising a seed. So we got a pre-seed, which is the early funding from A16Z. And now I'm raising my first seed round and I'm looking for a lead. And I would be like, well, how come A16Z is not leading? Like, they literally have infinite money. So they're seeing something that puts them into a bucket where they don't want to invest and they will take just the minimum ticket. Then that puts you in a bad position. So it can be really great, or it could be not that great. That would be my position.
I want to say this right away, is that I may be over my skis right now because I don't understand this stuff as well. But my understanding is that the way the Y Combinator works is that they invest early in these companies and then they pro forma invest in subsequent rounds. So they actually never take entire rounds. Like, that's the way the business is set up, and that's the way that this has been set up. But I am already hearing that A16Z is cherry picking deals and fully funding next rounds, which makes fucking sense because $750,000 is not enough money to justify even the effort of this bullshit, right? Because they have $600 million money to deploy, right? So if they do the next round and they are not contributing more significantly than their pro forma, then it doesn't even make sense. That's why this whole system doesn't make sense. I've talked to numerous people about this. It doesn't even make any sense. So I'm hearing that, like, yeah, they are now cherry picking. And so what the danger is that, one, they don't invest. That looks bad. But then also, if they fully invest, then no one else is getting involved.
Agreed, right?
And so it's like, okay, yeah, it's shut off from the market, like as a company, right? And you want multiple investors. And they may put pressure on these companies to do fully investing because they want to deploy. And when you have $600 million, the other thing is you have to understand is you have to deploy. You can't earn the fee unless it's deployed. Right. So you can't get the fucking 2%. Right. So they can't make any money, you know, until they deploy this funds. And these, again, $750,000 checks ain't going to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
And so we end up in a situation where, because of 600. So when Chris says it's a big fund and smaller funds could work, because in order for you to get money back from the VC, they have to return the full fund for the full 600. And then after that, the investors are getting 80% and the fund managers are getting 20. So that means that in order for the fund to be successful, they, you know, need to return at multiple billions. So that leads to a situation where you are that small little company, you better be Roblox next, because that is the path you have to be taking, where you IPO at 10 billion and then everybody's going to be happy. But the fact is also, with A16Z, you have all the resources to be the next Roblox, but you have to, you know, that's the game you're playing. You can't exit at at 100 million valuation. You can't exit at 200 million valuation. 300. Even when you're 500, you're like, yo, no, you're not exiting. You're riding this train all the way to NASDAQ. That's where the train stops.
We've said, now, obviously, this is a short-term problem, potentially, is that the IPO market is closed. There's not a lot of acquirers left in the industry, right? Everyone's retrenching, right? You know, fucking Embracer might be back. Who knows, right? It's clear, you know? There, he might be back in the game. And see, this is where people like Andrew and Andrew Chen and the rest of those guys, I mean, they're so much smarter than I am. So they may be, wow, they may be thinking way, you know, in the
next level.
That's why I'm over my skis. It's like these guys are like visionaries, right? So like maybe they have like this concept of what's going to happen 20 years from now, the fucking Nostradamus and shit, right? I can't see it. 8% to 9%, you can throw your money in the fucking VTI, you know? I have to imagine that's going to be a better return, doubling your money, more than doubling your money in the next like 10 years, you know?
No.
So I don't know, dude. I just don't know. All these big funds, I don't know.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm fascinated by this just as someone who worked at big companies. I didn't do a lot in this space. I am now doing a lot and I work with small companies and they're asking me, you know, what should we do? And so thank you for this educational section. I think we're going to do one more on Bitcraft.
Yeah, this is just the news. So just an update. So we talked about A16Z raising $7.2 billion. The other fund that raised was Bitcraft Ventures. They collected $275 million for their third early stage investment fund focused on gaming and interactive media. So Bitcraft Venture Fund 3 will continue to invest globally in studios, platforms, and technology with the gaming and interactive media sectors focusing on seed and Series A stages. And that brings their assets under management for $1 billion. There's a long-ass interview with Jens on VentureBeat. You can read that. All the best to them. This is a pretty sizable fund, to be honest. Like 300 is a lot.
I met with him at GDC. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Like in this environment that he's raising that much money, dude, that guy.
That's a lot of legwork. Like raising, and with A16Z raising so much, because they raised as a collective of the all funds, I think that is a little bit easier than you going around traveling to Saudi Arabia and you name it. And with your hat in your hands, just asking for $1 million there and $500K there and so forth. So the guys put in a lot of work and a lot of hours to raise this sum.
Yeah, it's almost half of that A16Z number that you just said from, you know, little Bitcraft.
They're going to run into the same return problem as well, right? Like, what are they going to invest at return? So maybe we should get one of these guys on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and talk this through because I am the math is not working for me.
So with all of this money that they can deploy, why are there still layoffs and closures? Chris, take us through what happened this week.
All right, Qualy, our boy Qualy, dude.
John Wright. Oh,
John Wright. They laid off 40 people.
I like that you put it on John.
I know. It's like the nicest guy in the world. Yeah. I can't even imagine him firing someone. And then Take-Two announced 5% layoffs, which, again, feels like, oh, me too, right? But, like, they say that they're canceling projects, but they're very unspecific on what they're actually doing. But one of it could be BioShock 4 was a speculation, which would suck.
No.
And then the big one, which we shouldn't be covering here, but we will, is that Elon is reducing workforce by 10% as fucking people start to realize that EVs are fucking expensive and far less practical than gas cars. So anyway, he's reducing his headcount by 10%, which is a significant amount of people, by the way.
I love my electric car. I'm not going to let you do. Yeah. Don't shit on my electric car, which is a BMW, not a Tesla, by the way. So what was interesting about Take-Two, and by the way, on BioShock, what a great transmedia. Like, can you imagine a TV show based on BioShock? My favorite, by the way, BioShock 1 is my favorite game of all time. Just throwing that out there.
That's one of mine. It's up there. At the time, it was just absolutely revolutionary. It was crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Blew my mind.
Like, he's a genius, that guy. Philip is not playing this game.
Never played.
Oh, all right, Phil, take us into games. Let's talk games.
Slay the Spire 2 has been officially announced. This is the OG roguelike in many regards. It's a CCG, and it's not going to be in Unity. It's going to be in Godot. So congratulations to them from breaking from the Unity trap here. Destiny 2, Godot. Destiny 2 player count doubles overnight after Into the Light, the Final Shapes prismatic subclass reveal. So it looks like they got more content going on. Bungie had some cuts as well. Maybe they're back in the game. The player count on Steam has risen from around 400 to 500,000 PSU all the way up to 80,000, essentially doubling overnight. Hey, look at content wins. Content is king. Disney Realm Breakers from Joy City Corp, which is a South Korean firm, has entered soft launch in Australia. This is essentially Rush Royale. I'm always amazed that like a Disney kind of metaverse IP still seems to not have broken through into the mainstream, except for that Game Loft Kart Rider game that seems to be killing it on Switch, but not so much on mobile.
Disney Emoji Blitz is pretty big with the casual audience. I think it's more difficult with the core audience. And listen, I could go do a whole deep dive on this, but a multiverse for Disney makes all the sense in the world, especially for a casual audience. I don't know if it's going to make sense in the epic Fortnite world. We will see. Oh, Cress has got thoughts on that later. We'll save that one. All right. Sorry. Keep going.
Quick update on POW World. You know, there's a lot of hype from it, but PSU continues to decline. It's in its lowest count ever, April 16th, at around 300,000 DAU on Steam. No idea what's up on Xbox. Let's continue to peek in on POW World. They have had some increases when they had content updates, but it still has not found its base yet. Some update from our sponsor, Sensor Tower. COD Warzone downloads continue to sputter. It's down to about 1 million last week. So week over week downloads continuing to sputter. Life to date revenue is only 3.5 million, but it's been steady at about $1 million a week. Unfortunately, DAU looks pretty flat. They're not stacking DAU. Not a good sign for Call of Duty Warzone. We'll continue to provide periodic updates, but looks like this one may be dead. AFK Journey, we were talking about that a couple weeks ago, looking a little soft. Downloads are falling pretty dramatically. We went from 1.1 million to 600,000 in the last couple weeks on iOS in the United States. It's down to 182 on the download chart for games, so it's falling pretty rapidly. Revenue peaked at 4.8 million per week. The revenue per download is really strong. Of course, like we don't know what's happening on PC. This is only mobile numbers, but it's weird to see revenue peak this early. DAU doesn't look like it's growing either. So just like Warzone, they're not stacking daily active users. You expect to stack daily active users as you go through all of these downloads, and then revenue should increase over time. Very strange not to see that happening this early. A lot of people were hyping on the AFK Journey train as like the second coming of Christ. Let's continue to look at this one. I'm a little doubtful. Maybe they front-loaded marketing revenue similar to the Genshin playbook. The game that is rising has been Brawl Stars. This is like the story of 2024, at least Q1 2024. It is on an absolute freaking tear. In December, it was doing about 800,000 downloads per week. Now it's pulling 2.4 million downloads per week. Revenue in December was 2.8 million per week. Now it's up to like $15, $20 million a week. The growth in this title is dramatic. It is extreme, and it is an incredible success story. We, of course, have talked about what's been going on in the game in prior weeks. We've talked about the talk that the GM Frank gave at GDC. I don't think any of that is actually doing justice to what's going on in this title. I think there's more of a story here than anyone is letting on that deserves a deeper look.
Yeah, I mean, it was Baby Shark, man. Like, that's the whole reason. There's no other reason except for Baby Shark.
Oh, stop. Please. That was painful to listen to. Really painful. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about content warning. They did a free release when the game came out for the first 24 hours. We now have some real numbers on how it's performed since then. It sold over a million copies in around 2 weeks. And that is in addition to the 6.2 million downloads it amassed through the launch campaign. Super, super impressive for the studio. Let's see if the strategy continues to grow and develop. I think the other game that I saw do this was like Total Battle Simulator. There's been one or two other games that have tried this strategy before. Definitely something I'd love to talk to you, Jen, about in future episodes. Rovio has canceled its Moomin puzzle and design game after more than 2 years in soft launch. What's going on over there in Finland, Mishka? 2 years in soft launch to see this thing go south?
Sounds like Breaking Bad, Phil. Remember that?
Hey, whoa, there was a phoenix that came out of that. It's called Star Trek Fleet Command. Oh. Leave Breaking Bad alone.
I think it's great that companies spent enough time on a game in soft launch, because it kind of, like, you already built it. Let's give it a chance to stand on its own two legs. And I really appreciate how Scopely has always spent so much time in soft launch, even on games like Breaking Bad, to really see if it has legs or not, like in that case. Phil, great, great game. I'm curious what Sega is thinking, because when you remove a game out of your roadmap, now you remove the income that you should be, or the revenue that you should be making of it. So that kind of brings down what is expected Rovio to deliver. And it's interesting to see. We saw that Sega is not as kind of a boss as everybody may be thinking. Like, we were talking about the Relic layoffs and so forth and Creative Assembly. So I'm not saying that there's going to be layoffs at Rovio or anything, but I expect that Sega expects them to deliver as been projected. And when they kill games that have been in soft launch for just such a long time, that's a risk. That is a risk.
Hey, game devs. Are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
All right, moving on to our first topic, which is kind of amusing versus an article. So the idea here is that the AAA video game studio is dead. What now? So the author of this Substack article is Chris Kalicki. Chris is now the founder, CEO, game designer at Notorious Studios, Inc., previously a game designer at Blizzard for 13 years on WoW, only on WoW, from his LinkedIn. I don't know Chris. Chris, get ready to be doffed. The gist of this article, let me just give you the background, and then I'll let the guys jump into their thoughts, is that he believes that indies will kind of take over the world. The AAA game dev is broken, leaving an opportunity for AA and indies to really innovate. You know, he references things like Pal World as an example of you know, what smaller folks are able to do. He goes on to make a lot of predictions about how game companies will need to change. The ideas that he has ranges from Mishka's favorite topic around hybrid work won't work, or maybe hybrid will work, but that in-person's important, to smaller core teams, to the games needing to be design-driven. Can't wait for Phil to chime in on that one. To players participating in dev, which I can comment on because, by the way, that's already being done today. And if you're not doing that, then you're a dumbass. Like, you absolutely have to engage your players. So a lot of it I found was like a little bit of what I call a no duh. But some of it I think you guys want to weigh in on. So Mishka, why don't you go first?
Yeah, there was another article on Games Industry Biz called Saber's Matthew Kark. Maybe it's pronounced Kark. That says the AAA gaming model is going to change. So this is kind of like part of this same type of rhetoric. Though this was a very much opinionated piece from a longtime staffer from Blizzard. And this Chris Kalicki is a writer, a game designer, entire career in Blizzard, as you said. On one hand, he has not been corrupted by the management layer. But on the other hand, we have to take it into account when you're reading this, he doesn't have the same context that managers tend to have at these big companies. So it's an interesting viewpoint. And it is an opinion piece because clearly nobody really went through this. And there's no such of a, like a critical review before this was released. So on one hand, he makes a statement, an opinion, but there's no counter to it. It's not like a balanced thinking on one hand, on the other hand, and this is what I think. It's more like one way. So I actually found that I agreed to most of the points. As Jen, you said, no duh, like makes sense. Like no to fully remote teams. Yeah, yeah, that's the data that we're hearing from most of the companies. There are some companies that are making it, but most of the companies, fully remote just doesn't work. He talks about smaller core teams. Interestingly enough, this is the same thing that in the Sabre CEO's interview came through. He was talking a lot about smaller core teams in the same sentence that you scale the production with these auxiliary teams that are based outside California or outside the expensive areas. He was mentioning Buenos Aires and Serbia, saying that you can have the same quality of results, same employees for a fifth of the cost. And that is kind of like how you save and create great games at the same time. In this article, it talked about cross-platform. Sure, we haven't just seen many great examples of cross-platform titles. Interesting point, he said something about good enough production values was one of the statements. That's something that doesn't come through AAA, and I think it's important to not push the production quality so high. And then keeping players as part of development. So Web3 is kind of showing the way with that. But anyways, there are a few points that I disagreed with. One was the sort of approach, I don't know, Jen, what you think about this, that marketing needs to be authentic and player-driven.
What the fuck are we talking about? Are we like circa 1999? What is happening right now?
This point I was like,
And then the same thing was the designers need to be the CEOs. So any CEO of a company should be a designer. And
dude, we've evolved past this like decades ago. Decades.
Yeah.
Decades.
Yeah. Maybe we should just jump over this article.
Well, what do you guys think? I do find that folks that worked at Blizzard or at Riot and that in some of these cultures, especially when you're in a specific culture at a big company for a long time. And this is, by the way, what has happened to me in working on all these big companies. Now that I work across all the companies, I kind of realized the error of my ways, that I got sucked into a lot of old school thinking, and that there is so much new thinking out there and everyone else has been evolving. But at the big companies, they're not able to kind of keep up with this new approach to gaming. That's kind of my impression in reading this. Oh. Is now that he's on the outside, he's like, oh shit. Everything that I know about being at Blizzard is very different now. Oh. And that's why I call it no duh, because he's seeing the light. He's seeing the light of all of, you know, everything else that we see on the outside. That was my kind of
impression. That's interesting. And the pendulum kind of swings over because then it ends up in like he reads books like Reinventing Organization and creates this whole argument that they shouldn't be any hierarchies. You should be driving, you know, basically this whole anarchist playbook against any big organization, how they're run. So, okay, now I kind of get it.
Yeah, that's my Jen. Like takeaway for folks. If you're listening and you're at a big company, know that there is a whole other world out there. There's a whole other way of doing things. Figure out ways to get exposure. This is like when I joked that I had never really been to GDC that often because they won't let you go when you're at a big company because there's, you know, your number one is you're going to share all the secrets, or number two is you're going to look for another job. But these are all ways for you to talk to other people and bring back that like new innovative knowledge to the big companies. Although it's really difficult to move the battleship.
I have to agree with you here. This is ridiculous. Like the majority of the revenue being generated by our industry is AAA game development, whether it's on mobile or console. Full stop, right? Like, look, we saw the Newzoo data that kind of says exactly what I've been saying for the last fucking 5 years on this podcast, right? And it's like new games were 8% of the playtime. New games, 8% of the playtime. And the majority of those were super AAA, right? Including Hogwarts, right? So it's like, no, you're wrong, right? If he had said, forget AAA for a moment, he said, hey, here's what to do as an indie. Hey, man, I'm all about that. That's fine, right? There is a market out there for small games and small revenue, right? go for it. The market's big, huge. But if you're talking about what's driving the market, the gaming market, it's AAA. It's big titles, both for mobile and console. So enough. You know, they've won the market. And I don't think there's any much room for anything else at these levels, right?
Absolutely.
So I don't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah, I think we also heard from, you know, Matt Piscatella and Circana and NPD. Their data also, in addition to the Newzoo data, he calls it the black hole of gaming, where all hours are going to games. And by the way, they're AAA games that have been out in the market for years. You know, the Minecrafts, the Fortnites, and all of those of the world. So I think it's a good point. I think he might be coming from this idea of, hey, if you're out in the world trying to start something new, this might be the way that you have to approach it to kind of start something up. And, you know, the one thing I wanted to say, just to wrap this up on the marketing side of things, is, and Chris, I know you disagree with me a little bit on this, that community is the new social, which replaced what was TV advertising. And the way that marketers are having to use community and influencers to really market the games is actually completely different than what it used to be. So I might even make the argument that AAA marketing is dead. And
I don't disagree with that. Well, I don't know. Why would you say
that? Every time I talk about community as like a really big, viable way to market things, you're like, oh, it's not going to scale. It's not going to do it.
Well, for Web3 is what I was really talking about. Okay. Like, okay. I don't know specifically what you're talking about, but no, I believe 100%. Like, you know, TV advertising always never made sense to me when I was at EA. I was always railing against it because it didn't have any ROI, right? Even back then, you know. And nowadays, you're right, influencers and social media, that's where marketing is now. So no, I don't disagree with there.
So let's talk about another AAA that is happening at Disney with all of the hires. We touched on it a bit last week, that they are basically hiring all these like experts from Blizzards and all these other, you know, companies to set up and do games inside of Disney. Chris?
Yeah, I've been battling it out on LinkedIn on this nonsense, but like, yeah, I mean, Disney, you know, gaming industry veterans like Sean Shoptow and like Ray Gresko and Bjorn, whatever the fuck, and Jay Ong, all these guys are joining Disney to build a team, evidently to do something, right? But what is that exactly? So I would argue that, you know, they're likely managing the business of licensing games, licensing properties to other people. But this is like on the tail of this big investment in Epic, you know, the $1.5 million investment in Epic. So I guess what I really wanted to get across here is that two big things. One, the investment in Epic is not Disney getting into games business. It is factually not. Okay. Now, I could be wrong longer term that they maybe are trying to get into the games business by building teams and building games. This is not an opinion. This is an investment, right? This is like buying stock on the NASDAQ, right? They bought $1.5 million of stock in a private company. Okay. Now, there's a fancy licensing agreement attached to this, right? So they are actually licensing properties from Disney, right? But this is a balance sheet transaction. Okay. And as far as I understand it, it was changing the narrative, you know, for the new, you know, CEO or new old CEO, Iger. And it's working. Stock's up 30%. So he's doing his job. Like, he's changing the narrative on the stock. So until they hire full development teams and pay money out of their own P&L, like, they are not making games at Disney right now. They are not making games at Disney, right? This is what I want to be clear on. But there's pundits out there. A few people have been talking about this, like, oh yeah, they're back in. They're in again. But what I would say is, not again. Please, not again. I can't go through this again. This is the third time, right? The first two times they failed so fucking miserably, and I had to watch it real time. At them failing because they don't know how to make games. They don't want to make games. The organization's not set up to make games. No one wants to go there to work to make games at Disney because it's not a priority, right? Okay, so that's the one thing. I want to be clear on this. And if I'm wrong, please let me know. But I don't think I am. Anybody disagree with me on this point?
I lived it as well. Except when I worked there, I was in consumer products. And so I was there during the era of Kingdom Hearts, the Tron game and Turok. Do you remember Turok when they bought Avalanche?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Dinosaur Hunter.
The Dinosaur Hunter. Yeah.
Of course.
So when I was there, it was like, we're going to get into games. And we bought Avalanche, and then Turok bombed, and they're like, we're out of games. And so and we talked about Heatherly, Chris Heatherly, who we, you know, friend of the pod, who did this something similar, Universal, where, you know, he tried to do stuff with Jurassic and other brands. And I think the problem is that you're right, Chris. Like, number one, is not a priority. Number two is they don't know how to do it. Number three is it's a public company. And in gaming, when you slip your dates or if you have a miss, like, everyone just throws up their hands and quits, which is ironic because they have bad movies all the time that they spend hundreds of millions of dollars making and marketing, but they don't have the same tolerance for the game industry. And so until there are folks that really understand and have the patience to do that inside of Disney, which they don't, and they, you know, a lot of the people aren't very different than it was 20 years ago, then I see it as a huge challenge. The only thing that is different this time is this epic investment, and maybe because it's so much, they have to have patience to wait that out. But I don't know. Like, they hired lots of game industry people in the past. Remember John Pleasance from EA went to run it, and
yeah, Playfish, right? Didn't they acquire Playfish? Disaster.
Yeah, they got their ass fucking kicked. Disaster. And so, I mean, I like the investment in it. I like the idea of content and story and all of these great things, but it just doesn't work inside of the Hollywood studios. For some reason, nobody can figure this out.
Yeah. And so, like, the 1.5 billion people keep talking about, but these games are being made and they're being funded by Epic at Epic's discretion, not Disney. Right. They'd have no control over this $1.5 billion that they invested in the company. This is Epic's money now. Right. This is not a second party deal. This is not a third party deal. Epic gets like 80% of this revenue and Disney gets about 20, right? 15 to 20, depending on what licensing agreement they sign. And I'm sure it's fucking complex, but this is what the arrangement is. And I said this the last time we spoke about this, is that this is absolutely fucking immaterial for Disney's P&L, full stop, right? They make $89 billion a year. So let's say they miraculously achieve like $2 billion in revenue from this Disney shit on Epic. That's $400 million to Disney at most, right? That is fucking mice nuts, absolutely mice nuts. I mean, it's a great margin revenue, don't get me wrong, but it is not material at all to Disney. So this is just corporate PR at its finest. It is changing the narrative of the stock, and that is it. That is all. It's a smaller scale Jen, right? Didn't she manage the Hasbro shit for EA for years and years and years, right?
Yeah, like, so, I mean.
But you were on the development side, though.
I actually was at Hasbro, but I made toys at Hasbro, and then I was at EA making games. So okay. I've been on both sides of, and then at Disney, I was a licensor. So I was, in a sense, working with partners to make games. And so the challenge with what they're setting up, and by the way, there is a litany of VPs underneath this. This is the most bloat that I have seen at Disney in forever because they're not doing anything. So approvals are going. Listen, I'm not necessarily defending this, but what I'm saying is they are trying to signal that they care. I don't think we know everything that they have working yet. I do know most recently the licensing business is the most glorious, beautiful business out there if you are a content holder of IP that people care about, because all you got to do is say, sure, you can do that. Let's do some paper. Let's do a deal. I'm going to do some approvals. You take all of the risk and I'm going to get my 15 to 25%. And it just rolls in. Like, it is a beautiful business. I don't know why they don't just keep doing that and why they need 10 VPs and even more expensive people to do deals. I mean, they must be saying they're going to make stuff, but you're right. The investment in that, it's mice nuts. Why are you taking your eye off the ball of theme parks? Put all of your money into theme parks, new IP, expanding. That's where Disney is winning right now. That's the cash cow.
My final point here, and actually I wanted to make this originally, the first point is that I do agree that they should be doing more games like with their IPs. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just suggesting let's not have them actually make games at Disney, because I don't think that is a good idea.
License it,
that is
right?
Not a good long-term viable strategy. No matter how much you want it to happen, how much it makes sense on paper, how much, you know, Booz Allen and McKenzie can put it on a fucking slide and make it make sense, right? It doesn't make any fucking sense. It has never worked. The only place it's ever worked is at Warner, and there were specific circumstances of why that worked. But every other fucking experiment has failed, right? NBC, Fox, fucking Disney twice. Fucking LucasArts was an absolute train wreck of epic proportions in every box away. Anybody you talk to that was part of that was just wanted to tear their fucking eyes out after fucking working at that place, you know? So anyway, just stop. And it's Chris Heatherly that's driving me insane. He should know better. You should know better. Oh. He's the one out there like pontificating this bullshit. Dude, they're not making games at Disney. They are not. And they will not. And if they do, I will be wrong. But if they do, they will fail. So
well,
whatever. All right.
Moving on, and maybe we should tip them if they do make some games. So there's a lot of controversy, at least in my LinkedIn, around the idea of tipping in games. So what had happened was former Blizzard president Mike Ybarra took to Twitter a few days ago to suggest a new form of showing developer appreciation, having the option to leave a $10 or $20 tip on a game you love. You know, I like the sentiment of this, at least. So here's what he said is, when I beat a game, there are some games that leave me in awe of how amazing the experience was, Ybarra wrote. At the end of the game, I'm often thought, I wish I could leave these folks a $10 or $20 tip because it was worth it. It was worth more than my initial $70, and they didn't try to nickel and dime me every second. So this was, you know, I thought kind of like a nice gesture he was saying is like, he talked about God of War or Baldur's Gate 3 or some of these other like really big, impressive games. And he got shit on in the press by people saying, hey, you know, the idea of leaving a tip, I've already given you $70. Like, now you want more money. How do I know the developer is actually going to get the money? So while tipping culture is kind of going crazy in the U.S., especially, and other around the world is a little bit different, I don't think his thought comes from a bad place. I think it comes from an appreciation place. Like, how do you signal that? And feels like this might work in free-to-play games or might work with some, like, indie games. So I like the thought, but the execution is where the problem is. And how do you make sure this goes to the right people? How do you do this in a way that doesn't feel like you're greedy bastards? Anyone have thoughts on this?
Well, we know that TikTok is making bank off of tipping. That's a different thing, of course, but they have a tipping feature. And that's where you tip the creators. We know Instagram is testing tipping. So the way I see this is definitely not what he meant, but the way I see tipping is more like, it unlocks the spending ceiling because you can, you know, if you're a real whale, you can essentially spend a lot of money on just tipping the creators. Now, I don't know. Tipping is so US based, like it doesn't really happen outside the US. I was just recently at GDC and I was again like reminded that here the price that is being asked, like you also need to pay to the staff because the restaurant does not pay for the staff. It's like an auxiliary service. So anyways, tipping is very weird outside US, but I get his point and I think it comes from a good place. I'm kind of amazed at the backlash. Like, where is this backlash coming from?
I think the tips are like captured in the premium SKUs for all these games, right? Which is a, you know, if you buy, it's a $70 or $60 game and you buy the $80 game or the $100 game, there's your tip, right? I mean, like, so, and that's the better way to do it, as Phil has said numerous times on the podcast, which I 100% agree. So tipping after the fact, very cultural and very weird.
Oh, you know how you could tip?
Argument.
Like, after you listen to this episode, you can go to and give us all the 5 stars. That's a free tip. That helps with the algorithm. You don't have to spend on anything. Just give us a thumbs up or whatever app you're using. That's a huge, hugely appreciated tip for the whole crew. We'll divide the stars among us.
Oh my God. I love how you turned it into something about us. Well done. All
this
right.
Podcast is about shilling.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. It's
I'll give you a tip. I'll give you a tip. Don't fart around campfires. There we go.
All right. Well, on that note...
All right, everyone. Thanks for another great week. Chris, hope you feel better. Good to have you back. And see you guys next week.
You did it. You made it to the end of the episode. As a fan of the show, it would help us out if you subscribe and leave us a review on the podcast service of your choice. More importantly,
Are you a member of the Deconstructor of Fun Slack group? If you have 5 years or more of games industry experience, go to deconstructorofun.com/slack and apply to join. Join the games industry's best professional community, filled with peers always willing to lend a hand. Or subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest insights from the Deconstructor of Fun content creators. Thanks for listening.